KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, and welcome back after a bit of a hiatus as Stanford baseball continued its march of success. Today, I'm very excited to have on the show the co-author of a fascinating new book called iBrain. The subtitle says a lot, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. The guest is Dr. Gary Small. His co-author, Gigi Vorgan, is not joining us today, so we'll be chatting with Gary today. In iBrain, Gary, and I'll refer to the book as Gary's, as he is the author here today, Gary and his co-author take a close look at what impact there has been on the human brain and human interactions based upon a human being's interaction with technology, and particularly the internet. This is a burgeoning area, and it's one that's we've discussed on Hearsay Culture in the past with people like Richard Lanham, author of The Economics of Attention, as well as Dan Sulov and John Palfrey and several others who have taken a look at the impact and the interaction of technology with children and privacy issues and so forth. But here we are going to be taking almost a physiological look of sorts at the human brain and how technology interacts human behaviors and literally the physiology of the brain itself. And in iBrain, Gary takes a very broad view of these different impacts. As you look through the table of contents for the book, it's a fascinating array of both the pros and cons of this interaction. As going through it, you have what appears initially to be a parade of horribles with subtitles like Anyone Can Get Hooked, Email Junkies, Virtual Gaming, Online Porn Obsession, Las Vegas at Your Fingertips, Shop Till You Drop, Getting Help, Driven to Distraction, Can TV Trigger Autism, Mystery Online Illnesses, Cyber Suicide, Fractured Families, and Cybercrime. And if I merely stop there, you think, my God, this is a book that spells out the horrors of technology. And indeed, Gary does look at those downsides, but also has a, I think, a very positive view of how humans will basically adapt to this new technology. And in that way, the book takes a comprehensive look at both the pros and cons of not only the internet, but of human interaction with it. In going through the book, and we'll be talking with Gary in just a minute, I wanted to open up our discussion and really contextualize the discussion today by quoting a paragraph on page 186 of the book, under the heading The Future Brain. Gary writes, as our society begins the brain gap, the future brain will emerge. Not only will this future brain be tech savvy and ready to try new things, it will have mastered multitasking and paying attention and fine-tuned its verbal and nonverbal skills. It will know how to assert itself as well as express empathy, have excellent people skills, and be able to nurture its own creativity. Gary and his co-author Gigi paint a, I think, overall a very optimistic picture of how we're going to be dealing with these issues. But meanwhile, in 2009, we have some serious challenges. By way of a brief background, Gary Small is the director of the Memory and Aging Research Center at the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at the Center on Aging at UCLA. His research has been quoted in a variety of major publications, including Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and USA Today. And Scientific American magazine has named him one of the world's top innovators in science and technology. Gary, thank you for taking the time today to join us on Hearsay Culture.
Dave, I really appreciate your interest in my work and in iBrain.
Outstanding. Well, let's get right into it. And what I always ask authors on the show is to discuss a bit more about their background and how you got interested in these particular issues.
I've spent over two decades studying the brain and studying how the brain ages. And in that journey, I've developed different kinds of technologies to measure what happens to the brain. Our group developed the first PET scan technology that allows doctors to actually visualize the physical evidence of Alzheimer's disease in living people for the first time. We've developed other technologies that have helped physicians make an earlier diagnosis, and have actually, a lot of those studies helped to change Medicare policy so that PET scans can be used sometimes by doctors to help with the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. So I have this background in technology and the brain and in aging, and at the same time, I've been impressed by other kinds of technologies that have sort of insinuated themselves into our lives. And it's at first it seemed to be sort of gradual with a cell phone here or there. The next thing you know, everybody's got a laptop. And I have teenagers who are, you know, walking and texting, and it's really kind of a digital revolution that we're all experiencing. And I was curious how that technology might affect the brain, and that was really the basis for the exploration that led to this book, and actually led to some studies at UCLA to understand the phenomenon better.
Was there a particular event or something that you observed, and perhaps a patient or someone you interacted with that said, you know what, there's a need for more research and even for a book written for obviously a wider audience on this topic?
Well, I think it was probably my own experience with it. I think that, you know, I can recall, 15 years ago where we hardly used the internet and we used the computers as glorified word processors. But then very gradually, the internet took hold in my work, and it became tremendously important, especially email, that all the business is conducted with email. We exchange manuscripts, and I would find myself spending hours on end doing email, and I would sort of feel kind of tired and maybe get a headache and feel a little disconnected after these email marathons. And at the same time, I noticed my patients. I'm also a geriatric psychiatrist, and how, in contrast to my kids, my older patients were sort of computer phobic. They wouldn't have anything to do with it. And so that was really the birth of some of the observations and this idea of, instead of a generation gap, we have now a brain gap between the older digital immigrants, my generation that came to the technology later in life, and my kids' generation, the digital natives who have grown up with it 24/7.
The subtitle of the book, as I mentioned in the introduction, is quite provocative, and I want to spend a little time talking about it before I get into the meat of the book and some of the interesting areas in it. The subtitle, as I mentioned, is Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Now, perhaps you could contextualize that by answering this question. What is ultimately the alteration of the modern mind caused by technology?
Well, I think this is a, you know, big issue, and we can think about it in two ways. One way is that the technology is altering our minds and our brains from moment to moment. We know from all this technology, from PET scanning and functional MRI, that any kind of mental experience will result in a sequence of biochemical reactions, neurochemical and electrical events in the brain that will process the external stimuli, put it into context in our brains, and we respond in different ways, emotionally, physically, variety of different ways. And those moment-to-moment experiences will trigger neural circuitry or neural networks that control these processes. And if you spend a lot of time with one kind of mental experience, the neural circuits that control it, in a sense, will strengthen. There'll be growth of synapses or connection sites between the neurons. If you neglect other mental experiences, the neural circuits that might control them will, in a sense, weaken. So from moment to moment, there is this alteration in our minds. But I think the bigger alteration, and this is where it's really more about brain evolution, that comes if we think of the principle of natural selection. And we know from Darwinian principles that genetic mutations that adapt best to the environment are most likely to excel. And if we're changing the environment our brains are exposed to, we're going to expect in future generations to have a different kind of wiring in our brain, that there's actually going to be an alteration of our minds. I think, you know, the term survival comes in there because that old idea of survival of the fittest in terms of evolution. And what will that future brain look like? Will it be horrific from some science fiction movie, or will it be a better brain? And as you mentioned, I'm glad you perceived that take that Gigi and I had on it, and that is that we're kind of upbeat about it. We love technology, and I think if we can understand it and harness it, it will enhance our lives. It already has.
I do take that upbeat note. I think it's important as we think about this issue, perhaps to contextualize it with the pessimistic or the not upbeat view. Is there a discernible real threat to the modern mind by technology? And if so, if you could paint, again, recognizing that this isn't ultimately the take from your book, at least in my view, but what is the pessimistic or non-optimistic view on this issue of survival? What is the worst case scenario in your view?
Well, yeah, I think there are some risks, and we detail some of them in iBrain. The, you know, the problems with attention, and there's mixed results. But there are some studies showing worse attention span or worse symptoms of ADHD in kids who spend more time with the cause and effect relationship is not completely proven, but there's enough concern in that area so that the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended no technology for very young children to try to protect their brains from that exposure during that critical developmental period when the brain wires are becoming more sophisticated and growing. There's a big concern about addiction. Now, this too is controversial. The American Psychiatric Association and AMA are debating whether can you really get addicted to the internet? Is it really the same as addiction to drugs or alcohol? I don't think there's that much of a debate in Asia, where they have a big concern about teenagers and other young people who seem to be addicted to video gaming, and they go to boot camps, rehab centers, to help them wean themselves from their video game habits that they've had a lot of trouble controlling, that have interfered with their lives. You know, we all know about not just the brain effects, but the you know, some of the cultural and sociological effects, some of the dangers of the internet, some of the problems with Facebook and security risks and political terrorism and so forth that some of the technology poses. So I think there are those kinds of problems. But I think the biggest issue that we try to address, and that gets back to my earlier point about spending too much time with one mental task and avoiding another, and that is that there's an impression that young people today are spending an awful lot of time with their technology. They're learning Facebook-to-Facebook skills, but their face-to-face skills are not developing. Mm-hmm. So they're not learning how to connect face-to-face socially, how to read nonverbal cues in a conversation, or how to look someone in the eye when they talk. And I think that's a concern that many people have, that we'll have a future society where we don't know how to talk to each other, that we won't have empathy in the way that we define it today, and it will redefine what we call human nature or humanity.
It's a fascinating area and quite daunting, and I think especially for the listeners and myself included who are not MDs, it would be helpful to take a step back at this point before we get into some of those major issues and kind of ask you a question that I'm sure is an unfair question even in an hour. I'm not going to ask you to tell me about the physiology of the human brain, but perhaps I'll just ask the question more narrowly this way. Is there a physiological impact of technology as far as your research or others' research have indicated? I mean, are we talking about a physiological difference in the brain, or is it something else, or is it impossible to de-aggregate these different items?
Well, we've seen in the study that we did, I mean, when I was researching iBrain, I found very little direct scientific literature on the effects of this technology on brain function and structure. There were a few studies on video gaming, and they were conflicting. And they looked at young people, and they looked at brain function before and after video gaming, and they saw in some studies there was a decrease in frontal lobe function. In others, there was an increase. The areas of the brain controlling addiction were affected in some studies, but not a lot of literature there. So the first study that we did that no one else had done it was to look at the brain when it was searching online, a very common task with technology today. And what we did was to recruit a group of people, and they were older, because we know older people tend to avoid the technology more than younger people. And we found about a dozen of them who had never used an internet search engine. And we matched them up very carefully with a group of people same age, same educational level, same male-female ratio in the groups. And the only way the groups differed was in their prior computer and internet search experience. And we, to do this experiment, we used functional MRI. So you take an MRI scanner, and people who have had an MRI know it's a very narrow tube you get into. You can't fit a computer in there. So we have these specialized goggles that we use, and we can show images on these goggles when people are in the scanner. And we can show them an internet page, and they can operate a little push-button pad at their side, which functions like a mouse. So we can present search tasks. And we compared that to getting information from reading a book, a more traditional format. And we compared the groups, and we had a very interesting finding. We found that the internet savvy people, so these are people with several years of internet searching experience, when they did the internet search task, there was a much greater extent of brain activation than people who were naive to the experience. And in fact, all the subjects looked about the same when they read the book page. There wasn't a whole lot of activity. But the only time we saw an increase were the internet savvy people when they searched online. And the area that was really affected was in the frontal cortex. So this is the part of the brain that makes decisions. And to me, that intuitively makes sense, because when you're searching online, it's an interactive experience. You're making a lot of decisions. So, I mean, there's some initial evidence that these kinds of activities really do alter from moment to moment brain function.
Does you mentioned using a search engine as an example of the testing that you did, but you also alluded to things like Facebook and other ways that human beings interact. I suppose there's obviously plenty of research to be done. Would you anticipate, and I'm asking a hypothetical here, but in your judgment, would you anticipate that there would be differing physiological effects based upon your tests when people interact through Facebook, or when they listen to music online, or when they are merely doing something passive, not even with a search engine, but just reading a web page? In other words, does the kind of activity entered into by the person impact the brain function?
Yeah, it's going to impact it. We haven't done all those studies. The science is in its infancy, and there's a lot to learn. But we do know from other experiments how specific the brain is when you stimulate it. So you can do an experiment where you have someone read a word or think about the same word or hear the same word, and completely different neural networks in the brain will be activated. So from those experiments and from the initial experiments we did comparing searching online versus reading a simulated book page, we can see the information was the same, but very different patterns of brain activity. And that will change over time. As the brain adapts and becomes better at using the search engine or whatever the mental task may be, you actually see less activity because it becomes more efficient. It's a little bit like working out at the gym or a physical fitness model where you can lift more weight with practice and exert less energy.
We're talking with Dr. Gary Small, co-author of the book iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Gary, let's get into some of the specifics of your book before we kind of pull out the crystal ball and ask some future questions. One of the topics that you focus on is what you call continuous partial attention, which you distinguish from the more common term or the idea that people are more familiar with, which is the idea of multitasking. What is continuous partial attention, and how is that different than multitasking?
It's similar in the sense that your brain is kind of hopping around, so to speak, from one stimulus to another or one activity to another. But it's a little different because what you're sort of doing is scanning the environment, always searching for that next bit of input that comes in that might be more interesting than whatever's going on at this moment. So, right now I'm in my office, and I suppose we all tend to do this to some extent. I've got two computers on, and I've got a view outside the window, and any moment, I could hear someone in the hallway, or my cell phone might buzz, and that kind of sends a signal to my brain wondering, was that just another email, or was it a voicemail? What out there do I have to attend to? And as a doctor, always being on call, I'm used to that, and it creates a certain level of stress. And I think that we're all subjecting our brains to this level of stress because the technology really lends itself to that. Most of us have a handheld device that's next to us all the time, and then we use these other devices, and so we can have several devices going at once, and certainly younger people do it even more. The average young person, they don't just watch television. They listen to their iPod, watch television, and talk on Facebook at the same time. They have two or three things going at once.
The idea, and I mentioned it in the introduction, but we've seen previous books talk about this issue of attention and the ability of human beings to give proper attention to a variety of tasks done from more of a sociological standpoint. And I mentioned Richard Latham's book, The Economics of Attention. Your book obviously is focusing more from a medical side, and I guess we get back to this issue of adaptability. Your idea of the brain gap is one that's interesting, and I guess the question becomes, continuous partial attention seems like something that for those that are older, and I even include myself, getting used to all these different interactions becomes problematic as you get older and you're used to one way of doing things. You mentioned this adaptability issue, and while it stands to reason that a younger person would, just by virtue of having more exposure to it, get more used to it, beyond that issue, though, is the question of the quality work that's being done. Is it possible in 2009 for the human brain to give the same attention to material that would necessitate and allow for the kind of quality output that we would expect? In other words, you're not going to be able to write the great American novel while you're looking out the window and you have two computer screens on and so forth. Or are we able to do that?
Well, I think you're touching upon a huge issue. And I think what's happening to us is with all the wonderful information gathering and communication technologies, where we have much greater breadth of information and ability to connect, but we sacrifice depth, that we don't spend a lot of time pondering issues, thinking, being creative in the old way. We're just dancing in a staccato fashion from one idea to the next because it's so easy to do. And I can see it in myself. The other day, my wife asked me a question. I don't know, can't remember what it was. That's my middle-aged brain forgetting the content. But it was something about a movie and so forth. So I just took out my iPhone and I searched it. And then the next thing I knew, a half hour had gone by and I had gone from one idea and thought to the other. I couldn't even recall what I had been looking at to begin with. And I think these kinds of experiences are very common among people. So young kids today, they're not memorizing as much because they figure they can look it up and they know where they can get it. And even the older generation is aware of this. Some people complain, is the technology worsening their memory because they don't remember as many phone numbers? It's all in their handheld device. I mean, my response to a lot of these concerns is, use the technology in a sensible way. You don't need to remember phone numbers, but learn how to remember names and faces. That's something very useful that you're not going to want to look up when you see somebody.
We're talking with Dr. Gary Small, co-author of the book iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind, on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU, and I recognize I'm asking this in tough economic times, but I'm asking anyway in the hopes that there are people that are still interested in making donations. You can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And you will get a very quick and a very enthusiastic response. Regardless of whether you give a donation, I do hope that you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture as well as to KZSU. Gary, as we get into these issues, another topic and another concept that you bring to the fore is what you call techno brain burnout. And again, that may seem like a self-evident term, but I'd like you to define it. And then more specifically, perhaps talk about whether techno brain burnout is something that would be confined only to people who use technology to the excess.
I think that's a term that refers to this kind of experience that many people complain of, that they're just tired, not focused, have some physical complaints of fatigue along with mental complaints of fatigue after spending hours and hours with the technology. And it's a very non-specific experience. It's something that hasn't been studied in detail, but it's something that subjectively many people note. And my advice is to use the technology in moderation, to take frequent breaks, to avoid this kind of side effect from overuse.
Is it merely limited to overuse? In other words, can one conceivably get this burnout because, as you mentioned, our brain in 2009 may not be wired to interact with this technology in a way that isn't exhausting?
I think it varies from person to person. Certainly young people who grow up with the technology have much greater capacity because their brains are growing. Their brains are going through a process called pruning, which means that 60% of the synapses, the connection sites between brain cells, are being pruned away. And that goes on all the way through adolescence. So they're becoming hardwired, in a sense, to use the technology, and they're very good at it. On the other hand, they have not fully developed their frontal lobes, so their complex reasoning skills are not comparable to a middle-aged brain. And also their empathy skills are not developed fully. So the question is, what will they be like in 20 years? Will they be a less empathic group of individuals? Will their complex reasoning skills be impaired? Now, there's a debate there. It depends on how they use the technology. There are some video games, for example, that are very complex and probably help players with their complex reasoning and forward thinking. Others may be very repetitive and not helpful.
The book is iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. I guess is Gary Small. Gary, I think this is a good time to focus on young people and the internet. On Hearsay Culture, we've had several authors on the show in the past year to 18 months, including John Palfrey and Dan Sullivan and others who have written wonderful books and done a tremendous amount of research on issues involving privacy, And ultimately, the issues involving a child's ability to make proper judgments on the internet. And what you've just described certainly underscores that we should be concerned about these things. Do you think that we as a society expect too much or too little from kids in terms of judgment when they use, especially in 2009, things like social media? What can we reasonably expect a child to be able to comprehend and not comprehend when it comes to all of the pros and cons of using social media, for example?
It's an interesting question. I think that we have to do our best to teach them about it, to teach them about the benefits and the potential dangers. There was an interesting study done this year where they looked at the effect of all this sexual information and inappropriate information that teenagers are putting out there on their Facebook or MySpace pages. And the investigator sent an email to a group of teenagers who were identified as being at risk, and said to them, you know, I saw this material. If I can see it, the teachers can see it, an employer, potential employer could see it. And they found that there was a significant impact on the kids pulling back on this information. So they could be informed of some of the dangers that when they apply to college or they apply for jobs, that recruiters will look at their Facebook pages, and it could be a negative reflection on them. There's an ironic situation here where people feel that anything goes on the internet, that it's very informal and you can, there's so much of it, nobody really cares, but it becomes a permanent record. And there have been companies that have been brought down because of one inappropriate email about some transaction. So I think we've got to teach it. We've got to let them know about what's up so they don't expose themselves to these dangers.
It's an interesting point, and I'm interested that you take that position, because it would seem from what you've described as the state, the physiological state or physical state of a child's brain, that perhaps there could be an argument that the child's brain is simply, or the average child's brains, I recognize that human beings vary, may not be capable of making all of the complex decisions necessary to make decisions that may not be as easy to make, the judgment calls that are closer to the line in terms of whether this is a good idea to put on the internet or not. Is there any basis to give that statement credence, or is that reading too much into your work?
Yeah, I think that people can be taught, children can be taught. But I think it's a challenge because the technology is so attractive and seductive to us, and it's so enjoyable. Our brains love it. It's exciting. There's images that change from moment to moment. It's interactive. It's empowering. And I think it's tough for educators today because they're competing with all this rapid fire information and entertainment using old methods of communicating and just being a talking head in a classroom, and the kids are bored and they're not engaged.
The another focus which gets into this area is the issue of internet addiction disorder, which, as you indicate in the book, is an idea and a form of disorder that's increasingly being accepted. What is internet addiction disorder? And I'm curious about the statistics on it in terms of the numbers of people, if we have them, that are being diagnosed with having this particular disorder.
Well, you know, it's hard to get a real estimate on what it is. It depends because there's so many different definitions of it.
How would you define it?
Well, I think that I would look at the proposed definition that pretty much looks for patterns of behavior, you know, where people, and it's very similar to any kind of addiction, where people become secretive about it, where they have a hard time letting go of it. And probably the most important criterion is that it's interfering with their daily lives. So there's a lack of control with it. So I think that there's different surveys where they find that, you know, maybe 10% of students have some, where they find that their technology use is interfering with their grades or their schoolwork. Some studies show it's lower, like 2 to 3%. So I think it's really hard to get a sense of it. I think, and even if people are not experiencing a full-blown addiction, many people have a hard time letting go of the technology. It does interfere with their lives in more subtle ways. You know, they're not attending to their spouse so much. They're distracted by their handheld device. I mean, I was talking to my teenage daughter the other day, and I said, you know, Rachel, when I'm having a conversation with you and you're texting at the same time, I just don't get the sense that you're really listening to me. And so she looked up from her texting and said, well, don't worry, Dad, I don't do that with my teachers, and then went right back to her. So I think it's, you know, it's kind of in more subtle ways it affects our lives, and it may not be a whole addiction, but it, you know, affects quality of life. And one of the things we do in our family time is to make sure during meals that there's no technology around, and we teach our kids to have conversations and look each other in the eye, and they seem to be able to learn it.
I recall, as you're speaking, some occasional news stories over the last few years about, or even blog posts about individuals who are self-professed geeks, who claim to be moving out of their home and moving into an apartment or a house with no internet access and no television because they wanted to get work done, which, of course, flies in the face of our conventional view of technology. I want to come back to what we initially talked about, because, you know, again, you know, you've run through several, you know, potentially very disturbing impacts of technology, and yet, as I indicated in the introduction, as you indicated in the book, you say, and this is a quote, that you believe that we will not only survive the technological alteration of the modern mind, but thrive because of it. Why should we be hopeful? Why are you, at the end of the day, hopeful that we are going to survive all of these potential pitfalls and actually be better off for the technology?
Well, I think, you know, human beings are smart, despite themselves. And, you know, when something is good and when it works, we tend to move toward it. So I'm optimistic. I think that some of these issues, and the big issue that we're concerned about is the loss of these human contact face-to-face skills. And in fact, there was even a recent study showing that young people who played video games, violent video games, had an impairment in recognizing the emotional content of a facial expression. So there's some data out there supporting it. But in a sense, this problem is only defined by the limitations of the technologies today, because how do we communicate? We punch a couple of buttons on a small handheld device and look at a little text that's either an IM or an email. But in the future, it may be much more sophisticated. We may have virtual images of people, 3D holograms of people we could talk to, you know, just as we see in a science fiction movie. So there wouldn't be as much concern about losing that face-to-face human contact interaction. And I think that we probably can achieve those kinds of advancements in the technology in a short period of time. The pace of innovation is just remarkable. In my generation, what was a big deal was color television or the Selectric 2 typewriter that could actually erase information from your typing page. But we're seeing just innovations day by day that are just unbelievable.
Does the iPhone and the mobile media device cause you any concern? And you talk about some of these issues in the book, but when people are walking around, I mean, you mentioned texting, but we're beyond that now. With your iPhone, you can be entirely in the same world that potentially you'd be in when you're sitting in front of your computer. Does that raise any particular concerns? The ability for people to be connected 24/7, not only through text but through visual media and audio and being able to check their bank accounts whenever they want to, and being able to turn their lights on and off in their home if it's wired properly, no matter where they are. I mean, do these particular mobile 24/7 type connections issues cause you any concern?
Well, sure, there's concerns because it makes us vulnerable to attacks from those outside of us, people who want to mess with our bank accounts or with our identities. It makes us more vulnerable because everything is out there. It also creates dangers because we tend to use these things when we shouldn't, when we're driving. People are texting. They're distracted behind the wheel. There was a recent study that found that even talking on the phone, even if there's no, if you're not holding the phone, just having a conversation with someone in the car creates a level of driving error comparable to being drunk. Hmm. And it makes sense. And it was different from having someone in the car who you're talking to. And it makes sense because just to carry on a conversation while you're driving, you have to imagine that person in your head, and it's distracting. And the different devices raise that level of distraction even more and more. So I think we've got to be sensible about it, but it's hard. It's hard for us because there's a lot of razzle-dazzle with the technology that draws us to it.
To address these concerns, you mentioned the things that you do with your family. I have a son who's a little bit just past 2 years old, and Noah sees Daddy working in his office. In fact, we were at a furniture store recently, and they had some props showing how certain furniture could be arranged. And before I knew it, my son Noah had grabbed the prop laptop. He'd put it on the desk. He sat down, and he was pretending he was in Daddy's office, which was quite endearing, but also, you know, showed me this is how one way that he envisions his father.
Right.
So I am a fan of technology. I use it. I support it. I teach it. What should I do with my 2-year-old son? I will ask about different age groups in a moment, but this is of personal interest, but certainly of interest to many other listeners, I'm sure, as well. What do I do with my 2-year-old to counteract the negative effects of technology and at the same time encourage that explorative mind and create a child who is not afraid of the technology and can embrace it and thrive?
Yeah, I think it's a question of balance. Some kids are very sensitive to it. If you plop some young kids in front of a television, it really affects them in a negative way. Other kids, it doesn't affect them as much, or they're not as interested. And I think parents having conversations about these issues and observing their kids is very important, and balancing the tech time with more traditional kinds of social interactions, face-to-face play, active play, going outside, interacting with pets and animals. So I think it's really a question of varying the interactions. And from everything we know about the brain, that's probably a good thing.
Is this the functional equivalent in terms of how we interact with technology with the old saying that certainly I grew up with, which is, you know, the TV is the idiot box, and we should only have a certain number of hours in front of the TV, or is it more complex than that?
Well, I think it's similar but more complex, and, you know, some people who are, skeptical about technology altering their brains will say, well, my grandmother told me TV would rot my brain, and look at me, I'm fine. Certainly all these things in moderation are not going to hurt us. It's really a question of trying to use them in moderation, but not forgetting other parts of our lives.
The book is iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. The guest is Dr. Gary Small. Gary, we have about 8 minutes left, and I do want to kind of get into this prognostication mode, if you will. You mentioned ultimately your view of being hopeful, and I'm curious from your perspective, if you were to devise a research agenda to be able to nail down your positive view of the impact of technology, what would it be? In other words, what do you think are the critical next steps from a research perspective that should be performed in order to get a clearer idea of the impact of technology on the brain?
Well, I think that we need to understand its effects according to age. We need to look in more detail whether there are these concerns about attention deficit, which is a big problem in young people, if it really is having a negative impact on social skills, finding out what the dose is, if you will, that is causing a negative effect, so we can drive policymakers and really think what makes sense in terms of recommendations for young people, how we can design the technologies so that it benefits our brain.
You mentioned
starting to see this with older people, and there's a huge area of brain fitness where lots of companies are developing technologies that exercise an older mind to make it sharper. And certainly even with young people, there are different programs to improve learning skills. And I think I want to see more of that. I want to see us understanding how we can improve our brains with the technologies rather than, having it impair our brain function.
You know, we can, as we think about the different age groups, and we talked briefly about a two-year-old, we can talk about teenagers. It seems that there would be an obvious point where, as a parent, you would say, enough's enough, and you're using technology too much. Putting aside the person that only communicates through text or is incapable of a person-to-person interaction that involves looking at the person in the face without a hologram, what should parents of teenagers be doing, or more specifically, what should they be looking out for in particular as major warning signs that perhaps there's a problem? But again, I want to focus your attention on how do we do that without creating teenagers that are adverse to technology or won't embrace it.
Well, I think what you need to look at if there really is a problem. I mean, some parents will complain to their kids, well, how can you do your homework if you're video conferencing with your friends? And they'll say, well, we're doing our homework together on Skype or with our MacBooks, and so we're talking to each other and it's helpful. So I think if the kids are getting good grades, if they're interacting socially, if they're having a good time, they don't seem to be grumpy, and they can have a conversation, then there's no problem. But if you find they can't look you in the eye, if you find their grades are slipping, if they tend to isolate, I think then it's time to look into it and start to have conversations. It's easy when they're young. I mean, you have young kids, and you can easily restrict them. But when they become teenagers and get a little older, it's harder to restrict them. And I think a better approach is to talk with them about it. I think they'll be interested about these issues. In the launch of iBrain, I've talked to a lot of schools and continue to do it. The parents are very interested in this topic, and the kids are as well. They want to know what they should do to make their lives better.
Let's go to the other end of the spectrum, which are people, older people who are coming to this technology later in life. What should someone, again, in that age range, who did not grow up either as a child or as an adult for most of their life dealing with this technology, but wants to embrace it, do? In other words, you mentioned this this techno brain burnout, which would seem to be something that could obviously happen to people of any age, but perhaps people who are older and not as used to technology might be more susceptible to it. How can they combat the negative effects of technology?
Well, I think older people, I really encourage them to get involved with technology, and a great way to do it is to learn about it through their kids and their grandkids. And a lot of grandkids have taught their grandparents how to use email, and it's a great way to communicate with them when they're at a distance. So I think it's a wonderful way. Once you have a purpose on the computer with the technology or with the handheld device, it becomes part of their lives, and I think it will it'll help bridge the generation gaps and even the brain gaps. So I think it's a great thing to do with family members.
Gary, in the remaining couple of minutes, I want to ask you a question, which may sound unfair, but I will preface this question. Of course, you're speaking to a lawyer and a lot of lawyers that listen to the show. I will preface this by saying you are not a lawyer, and I'm not asking you for legal advice or to prognosticate or offer any legal advice. But I'm curious, and you may not have a perspective on this, but is there anything that the law could do or policy on a national level that could help us deal with these issues? Do you have any thoughts on that front?
Well, you know, I think that we don't know enough to drive policy. So I think what we could do is to maybe fund more research in the area to really understand it. Let's recognize that it is having an impact on our lives and our brains. Let's understand it better so we can get the data to help drive the policy.
My wife occasionally jokes with me because of how often I use a computer, that the computer is basically my mistress, and so she makes that reference several times. And I, and in reading through your book, I sat down. One of the things you've done in the book is offer a number of quizzes or questions to give you, I'm sure, what would be a cursory, but kind of an idea of where you might fall with some of these disorders. And I'm pleased to say that I did not fall below a point or two of any major problems that that I could perceive. And so your book was helpful on that front.
Good. I'm glad there's still hope for you.
I'm still hopeful, yes. Your book gave me more hope for my future rather than less, which is a good thing. Gary, for those people that want to learn more about your work, obviously iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind is a good place to start, but I know you also have a website, so perhaps you want to mention that.
Yeah. They can go online to drgarysmall.com or drgarysmall.com, and they can learn more about iBrain, some of my other books, and some of the places where I'll be speaking.
Any projects coming up that you want to mention?
Oh, you know, I'm involved with a lot of very interesting research at UCLA, understanding the aging brain, and we actually have done a follow-up study with the technology, and we found that some of these technologically naive older people, when we had them search online every day for a week or two, that it caused alteration in their neural circuitry. They started looking like the people who had had many years of experience. So that was quite interesting. We should be publishing that soon. And Gigi and I are working on our fifth book, which will probably come out sometime in 2010.
Terrific. Well, you know, I certainly have appreciated you taking the time today and enlightening listeners of Hearsay Culture, and I invite you back on the show when your book comes out to continue the discussion.
Great. I look forward to it. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Take care.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up in the remaining several shows this semester. The Hearsay Culture was impacted by the Stanford baseball schedule, but the baseball season is over, and so Hearsay Culture will continue its regularly scheduled programming. Coming up next week, I'm very excited to have on Professor Michael Geis from the University of Ottawa, who will be discussing, and we will be discussing ACTA, bizarre, I'd say, treaty being negotiated dealing with piracy issues. So I'm excited to have Michael on the show next week. For the remaining shows, we will have on Mark Lemley, Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford, and Dan Burke, who are co-authors of a new book on patent law. And we're also going to have on Professor John Kunich from my school, Charlotte School of Law, discussing the variety of work that he does, including a book that he's written recently involving leadership issues in technology based upon the Chicago Cubs baseball franchise. So as for those of you that are baseball fans, I think you'll find that interview particularly interesting. We are going to go into a hiatus period for a few weeks, and then in the summer schedule, starting in excuse me, in July. I'm very excited to mention a variety of guests, including Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia, Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Jamie Boyle from Duke Law School, John Taranian from Chapman, University School of Law, Michael Heller from Columbia, Siva Vaidyanathan from University of Virginia, who has a book forthcoming in the fall called The Googleization of Everything, Susan Merritt, author of a compendium of articles and other essays on government secrecy, Kazis Varnelis and Geert Lovink, who will both be on discussing technology theory, Alex Halavay from Quinnipiac, who has a great new book called Search Engine Society, Professor Gordon Hull from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, who will be on the show discussing ethics and philosophy in technology, and Professor Wendy Chun, who will be discussing identity issues and technology. As always, you can listen to the show a variety of ways. The main way to listen, for those of you listening at 5 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, is by listening on KZSU FM. You can also stream the show at kzsulive.stanford.edu. For those of you who listen by podcast, you can pick it up through iTunes. You can also pick it up by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And last but not least, going to hearsayculture.com, where you can pick up all previous shows, the upcoming schedule, and monitor Hearsay Culture for any unusual activity. I always encourage and would certainly welcome any comments and suggestions and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, that's dave@hearsayculture.com. So I want to thank you for listening today to the show. I hope you enjoyed it, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.